Right. Just waiting for this to come up. While it's coming up, this is this weekend's Guardian. It's got a big picture of DNA, and underneath it says, DNA, it's war. And this is war between the UK and the US, between the private and public sector. So it's about Sulston versus Venter, if you want to read it. On a slightly more scientific level, a month ago, Science magazine, pictures of the fruit fly on the front, and if you hold it this way, then that is the complete genome of Drosophila. So that is the first genome of, you know, a full animal to be sequenced and determined. And that is what the excitement's about at the moment. I'm going to go through at internet speed, which is five times normal speed, so you're going to be left breathless deliberately. And I'm going to talk about biology, chemistry, and a little bit about medical. Now, this is being driven very hard at the moment, and we're seeing several factors. First is the exponential growth, which we've seen, the Moore's Law and so on. And this is due to advances in technology, advances in informatics. If we know informatics is going ahead, then we can go ahead at the same speed. Globalization, this is a pan-planet activity. And then a huge amount of expectation. So expectation from the public, from the patient, from the taxpayer. All these people are expecting something to come out, so there's an enormous excitement about doing more and doing it quicker. And then, of course, as we've seen here, a tremendous amount of investment in the potential outcome in terms of new therapies, new agriculture, and so on. The second thing that's happening, which I think is different from what we've heard up to now, is that experiments are being done in many different areas, and when those are combined, the vision is enormous, so that we can see biology, chemistry, and medicine all being combined, and even if these are not enormous at the moment, you multiply them together, then it is. We also have our in silico experiments, so whenever a new gene is found, it's avidly searched against all the existing genes to see what it's like. Computers which are going full pelt, doing nothing except comparing genes with each other, classifying them, and working out how the molecules might. Main tools of modern bioinformatics, the database. And he suggested that one should archive one's data, and in 1965 helped set up the crystallographic database, which had been the model for much of what I'm going to talk about. And here you can see the exponential growth, and you can also see the size of problem growing. And if scientists are left to themselves, then they will get more ambitious, demand more research funds, and I'm sure all the funding bodies know this. So there's a natural exponential to scientific work. And just as Moore's Law doubles every 1.5 years, so our collection of protein sequences has doubled. And up to now, it's been nice because the doubling period of about every 2 years is much the same as Moore's Law, so that every time you get twice as many sequences, you've got twice as much computer for the same amount of money. But what biologists, chemists, medics are working in lots of different fields, and all of those fields can be combined. So although the powers of 10 are not very big here, compared with the things we've heard of before, when you multiply them together, then they do get very large. So we have perhaps 10,000 to 100,000 genes in an organism. We have about 10 million compounds in the chemical literature. If you ask how does each of those compounds interact with each of those targets, then you get up to 10 to the 12th. And if you also say, well, when is it going to happen in the development of that organism, or what organ is it going to happen in, then you can conceive that the number of experiments you could possibly do is enormous. And you're up to any number of 10 that you like. And there are, for example, companies which will sell you software to create in silicon up to 10 to the 13th compounds. So we are not afraid of large numbers. And much of this is supported by robotics. Let's have a look at some pictures here. So Here are some of the organisms which are being intensively studied, whose complete genome is either known or nearly known: bacteria, yeasts, worm, fruit fly, mouse, and human, perhaps in 2 weeks, so the Guardian tells me, right? Another one. Here's the Drosophila. Every little bit of this fly, the fruit fly, has been very heavily studied, and it's known where different genes are expressed. So all of these are the different parts of the fly, and you can find out what gene is expressed where, at which period of development, and so on. So you can ask huge numbers of questions and, in principle, answer them. Here is what we can do with cells. Now, what we're seeing here are different fluids and different cells in the human body, and for each of those we can find out what proteins are present in those cells, which proteins are expressed. And you can see that different organs have got very different patterns of proteins, as one might expect. So there could be 10,000 proteins in one of those pictures there. And we'll look at that in more detail in a minute. So if we go on then to look at that in a minute, other things here, we've got 10 to the fourth human diseases in the WHO catalogue of diseases. And there are 10 to the ninth human beings who can probably pay for their medicine on this planet, and they're all going to want to know something about their individual makeup. So when you multiply all of these together, you get very, very large numbers indeed. Sorry. Clicked one too many. Right. Now, here's a picture of one of those proteomes, as it's called, the proteins expressed in a particular tissue. And all of these are labelled. If I click on one of those, it will tell me what the protein is. So we move from one discipline into another, and this is often referred to as drilling down. You saw all that data. We're now magnifying it because we had 10,000 proteins. We're looking at one of them. And this is a protein I discovered by chance when I was doing this example. I worked on it some time ago, about 10 years ago, interleukin-1 receptor, possibly as an anti-arthritis target. And here you can find out all of the different data and annotations that have been collected. You're not expected to read that, but this tells you about the different polymorphisms in different humans, the references, much of the biology. And then here, we're coming down to your beautiful pictures. This is pictures of what the molecule actually looks like. And I'm delighted to see this because when I worked on it, we could only guess. We ran computer simulations, and here's a real crystal structure, and another one. And then this is very interesting because what this is a result of a molecular simulation. This has been run for a long time in molecular terms, probably a nanosecond, but computed at femtosecond steps, so there's probably 10 to the fifth observations in this on the time scale. And this is just a picture which shows all of that data, or some of that data, put together. So it gives you the idea of the amount of computation that could happen just on a single protein. And then here, part of the paradigm of modern biological therapy is how that protein, the antagonist, interacts with its receptor. So this is a crystal structure of how those two interact. Now, the exciting thing about this is that if we have good enough models for it, we might be able to compute it without having to do the crystallographic experiment. Or alternatively, we might be able to discover molecules which bind here and act as small molecule drugs instead of having to make this rather large and possibly difficult therapeutic agent. So the excitement is that this gives us a real opportunity of simulating nature and perhaps doing even better. So the primary tool is the database, and here I've put a very few of the databases. So there's probably 200 databases in mainstream biology, maybe many more, and each species is getting its own database, and the database of proteins, genes, expression profiles, comparison, all sorts of things. So there's a vast amount, and it's very, very difficult to keep up with this. So I'm going to give you here some data which actually we use as part of our virtual education for students to get a feel for what goes on. Here is reverse transcriptase, one of the targets, one of the proteins in HIV, which is a target, target for AZT. So many strains, we go in and have a look at it, it's an enzyme, and straight away we can link in to where it is on the biochemical pathways. So I think since this has all happened in the last two or three years, this is a complete transformation of the way that we look at information. We can click anywhere on that diagram and find out what other proteins it interacts with, what small molecules it processes, and so forth. A huge amount of information within that. Now, because of the excitement, the pharma companies are investing heavily in this, and I've scraped this off two websites. Here's from Glaxo Wellcome, my old employer. Between 2 years, the capacity to screen the compounds increased 100-fold. That's much more than Moore's law. And here's Pfizer. Within 10 years, the ability to screen chemicals increased by 2,000-fold. That's probably also beating Moore's law. So we are already seeing that the technology is lining up to move possibly faster than our computers can cope with. Another thing that's moving is combinatorial chemistry. Now, 10 years ago, a chemical company, a pharmaceutical company, could perhaps make 10,000, 100,000 compounds a year. This is what a chemist looks like nowadays. It's not a human anymore, it's a machine. And it makes chemicals by a sort of heads, body, and legs. You take 50 of this reagent and 50 of this reagent, multiply them together, and you can get huge numbers of compounds. So here, if you have 100 of one, 200 of another, you've got 20,000 compounds, and you can make all those compounds in a day. Similarly, when we come to screening, this is a very recent announcement by a screening company called Affymetrix. This is a gene chip. And on this, there are 2,000 human genes. The chip is made by lithography, computing technology, but it's DNA which is stuck onto the chip. And that is a tool which allows fluids to be screened for the presence of genes. So that this technology, in principle, you can really see Star Trek walking into your physician with one of these, and they just take a bit of your body fluid and tell you immediately what's wrong with you. And that's the dream that many people have now got. Huge concentration on genetics. So the pharma companies here are saying that genetic information is going to be key. Now, about a month ago, Glaxo Wellcome announced a new drug which was going to be used in conjunction with a chip to find out which patients would respond. This was an HIV drug, which patients would respond well to this therapy and which would not. So we're beginning to see that the patient information is going to be critical in treatment and even in drug design. So one starts to see these huge numbers being multiplied together. So this then takes us on to healthcare. This is an area that I'm involved in at the moment. And this is where it starts to become difficult, because up to now we've been talking about the inanimate world. And when we move into the animate world, we have to map our informatics processes onto people. And people don't fit neatly into these models. And electronic health records. I've just come back for a conference on new drug applications. A new drug application has 1 million pages of A4 equivalent. The size of these is going up by 35% a year. Clinical trials are larger, require more data, and so on. So there's an enormous drive towards making all of these electronic. We're going to be seeing telemedicine as a way of saving all sorts of costs, and in my own area, e-pharmacy and e-prescribing. Now, e-pharmacy and prescribing are both now close to mapping on to the commercial process, and I'll mention commerce in a minute. Let me give one example here of how this can be combined. This is a patient record of a real patient named Stephen Socrates, that's fictitious, from Oswestry, which is one of the leaders of electronic patient records in the UK. And here, if we click on these, we can find the definition and other information of all of those things in the record here. And these are coming out of the WHO dictionaries and other dictionaries which are used in this area. So we're able to link together information in that way. I just have to click back a bit. So we're in a position where everything is going on very rapidly, and although people are working very hard to make it work together, it's going so fast that you can't plan it all. It's happening, and so you have to react. And this is, again, coming back to Bernal. And this is our challenge, to get the best information in the minimum quantity, in the shortest time, from the people who are producing the information to the people who want it, whether they know they want it or not. So the challenge is to produce information for people you've never met and don't even know exists. And that's a tough challenge. But it's a challenge which is being taken up in e-commerce, because that's exactly what's happening in e-commerce. You want to sell something to people you've never met. You want to buy something from a company you've never heard of, and you want the process to work without any glitches. And this is the major driver for technology on the internet. And so the World Wide Web Consortium, which was formed out of the efforts of what happened at CERN. So Tim Berners-Lee left CERN to set up the World Wide Web Consortium, this vendor-led consortium, to develop protocols for e-commerce. And its activities are to produce vocabularies, and I'll mention that in a minute, and processes. And all of this is highly relevant to how we're going to manage scientific, technical, medical information. Now, I'm involved in that through an acronym called XML, which is, some of you may have heard of HTML. Well, this is the next development. It doesn't supersede it. But it's designed for e-commerce, for machine-to-machine communication. And one of the key things is to generate these vocabularies, the metadata that we've heard about. And so this is a way of producing plug-and-play, Lego-like applications which you know are going to be able to work together even though the people are designing them separately. And so we're starting, it's not a complete solution, but it is certainly part of the solution. And so I've developed something for chemistry here. This is called chemical markup language, and I'm just going to show you that it exists. So it transmits, this is real live information. It's not a real chemical, of course, but it is a real live bit of information. I can do things with it, and this is a real live spectrum, and I can zoom in, and so on. So we can transmit objects over the wire that can do things and tell you how to use them. So finally, let me put some challenges here. The challenges are, I think we have to develop open standards. So much of what we've done up to now has been closed, it's been unreadable, it's been kept to a few people. We need open data, and by that I don't necessarily mean data in the public domain, but data that we can see. So everyone is demanding greater access to data. I think there's a general paradigm that the internet is the knowledge repository for the human race now, and we have a right to know a large amount of what's on it. Open source is the movement to share one's computing effort with other people. We've heard about metadata. We need reliable semantics. When we pass a bit of information from person A to person B, they need to be happy about what to do with it in the way that you weren't with the love bug. So that the semantics of that were not clear, except to the author. We need to know, when we get something from somebody we've never seen, how to use it and make sure it's going to be beneficial to us. And finally, I think that trusted organisations and learned societies have an immensely important role in this century. They are permanent, robust, impartial, committed, responsible. All of those things are very important values. Probably most learned societies underestimate their value, and they need to do more to promote what they could do. And I'm sure your foundation will take a lead from that.